and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington on this pre-recorded program. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, June 2nd, 2020. A South Sudanese minister for East African Affairs dies in Juba.
It's a great loss to the nation. It's a great loss to the people of South Sudan.
And 20 more people died in an attack in Morobo County.
Five of them were shot with a gun in one house. 10 of them were found yesterday in the evening, slaughtered with the knives in the bushes of Panyume area.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The South Sudan government has confirmed the death of the Minister of East African Affairs, John Luke Jock. Information Minister Michael McQuay describes Luke as a nationalist who believed in peaceful resolution of conflicts. Late Luke was the Justice and Constitutional Affairs Minister at the time South Sudan got its independence in 2011, and he is also credited for being the brain behind South Sudan's transitional constitution. For VOA News, Wake Simon Wood reports from Juba.
Makwe says Luke died early this morning in the capital Juba but did not describe his cause of death. He says South Sudan has lost a nationalist figure who participated in several struggles that led to South Sudan's independence, as well as more recently in efforts to restore peace and stability across the country.
It's a great loss to the nation. It's a great loss to the people of South Sudan because John Luke had contributed a lot, and himself and myself, we have done a lot in this legal sector and in the negotiation and in all aspects of governance system in South Sudan. So his death is actually not a loss only to the community, to the family, but a loss to the people and the government of South Sudan.
Luke was South Sudan's Minister for East African Affairs, serving on a ticket of the former detainees in accordance with the power-sharing protocols of the 2018 Revitalized Peace Agreement. Luke served in several ministerial positions, including Minister for Petroleum, Energy and Mining. He also served as South Sudan's Minister for Justice and Constitutional Affairs from 2011 to 2013. Before the recent ministerial position, he was the Minister for Transport. Luke helped craft several laws in South Sudan and Sudan, according to Makwe, who tells South Sudan in Focus that Luke participated in the drafting of the transitional constitution of Sudan following the signing of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, or CPA, the deal that ended the Juba-Khartoum conflict in 2005. John Luke is remembered as the person who drafted the current constitution of the Republic of South Sudan. But some South Sudanese blame Luke for giving the president too much power in the transitional constitution, including the power to fire and appoint office holders at will. Although he had fell out with President Salva Kiir in 2013 and became an opposition politician, Makwe says Luke had always looked at South Sudanese political issues in nationalistic terms.
Despite the fact that he was on the other side of the opposition, nevertheless he was in the government. But when we go for talks, he sits on the side of the opposition. But John Luke had ever been realistic and straightforward on national issues. John Luke had never stood against the government on issues of governance.
Luke is described as the John Luke of SPLM, a name by which he was known while serving as the spokesperson of the SPLM in London. During the peace negotiations between Juba and Khartoum, Luke was one of the legal advisors to the late Dr. John Garang, known as the father of South Sudan. South Sudanese politician Kosti Manibe, who was detained with Luke after the government accused both men of attempting a coup in Juba in December 2013, refers to Luke as a meticulous politician and a lawyer.
He is that our lawyers approached to issues, so being meticulous and always writing down. Whenever you are having meetings and having discussions, he always keeps a very detailed notes of that. So he is a very diligent person.
Luke is believed to have been born in 1952 in Akoba, Jonglei State. He was educated at the University of Khartoum in 1974 to 1977, earning a law degree, and graduated from the London School of Economics in 1983. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Leaders from Morova County say 21 civilians died during an attack by unidentified gunmen in two separate incidents in the area on Monday. Remigio Lasso Peter, a lawmaker representing Morobo County at the Transitional National Legislative Assembly, says 15 of the victims were from his home area of Panyume, which is under the control of the SPLM-IO. The Archbishop of the Central Equatorial Province of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan, Paul Yugusuk, confirms the incident, saying the latest attack has caused mass displacement of civilians in the area. Lasuba Memo reports for VOA from Juba.
Lawmaker Remigio Lasso Peter says all the victims from Panyume were men, including two Ugandan nationals.
Five of them were shot with a gun in one house. 10 of them were found yesterday in the evening, slaughtered with knives in the bushes of Panyume area. Until now, I don't know exactly how many more people will be found, but 15 are already identified and buried yesterday. Some are to be buried today.
Lasso says all inhabitants of the area fled into bush after the killings. Paul Yugusuk, Archbishop of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan's Central Equatorial Province, says six other people were killed in Panyana the same day.
We cannot deny that. It's not only in Morobo, even in Panyana, the border of Congo. Our people also have been killed there. And the attack is all over in Equatoria. Attack is all over in Central Equatoria, especially in my province. And we are indeed very sorry for these incidents, especially in Equatoria. We do not know exactly why this, but I want to hold both our SSPDF and then the opposition responsible, because they are not fighting among themselves. They are not supposed to fight among themselves.
Panyume resident Batale Simon says his father was killed by the attackers. Speaking in Arabic, Simon says his father's corpse was picked by Ugandan police along with the bodies of the two Ugandan nationals.
I asked the authorities in Uganda, and they gave me an approval that we can go and bring their body. They said if the place is far, my father should be buried there. But I told them the place is just 1 mile from the border, so they accepted.
Simon says he tried to access the area today to move his father's cattle from the area, but he says the armed men who killed his father are still roaming through the area. Lasso says the area is under the control of the SPLM-IO, but says he does not know who and what group is responsible for his father's death. Colonel Lam Paul Gabriel, SPLM-IO spokesperson, confirms Panyume is under the SPLM-IO, but denies his group attacked civilians in the area. He accuses National Salvation Front or NAS forces dressed in civilian clothes of attacking SPLM-IO positions.
What happened on Friday was that these civilians by themselves, they came with, not even, I don't call them really civilians, because these were armed soldiers of NAS. They came with few guns, but others were carrying these pangas, machetes, and bows and arrows. They attacked our base and killed one soldier and wounded some three. These soldiers, of course, they fought back.
NASA spokesperson Suba Samuel denies NAS fighters attack civilians. Samuel accuses SPLM-IO forces of carrying out the attack on civilians.
If it is a confrontation which is of course going on between the HSPDF and the IO, because there's a joint operation between them. So this was seen, this is going on. Then what is the essence of attacking the villages? What is the essence of killing civilians? What is the essence of burning the hearts of the civilians in Kogito area? What is the essence of looting their cows and of course killing, like what happened on the 31st?
Archbishop of the Central Equatorial Province of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan, Paul Yegusuk, is calling on the warring parties to respect the permanent ceasefire and stop attacking civilians. For VOA News, I am Lasuba Memo in Juba.
Since the COVID-19 outbreak, Ghanaians have been heading to a plant research center outside the capital Accra to hand scientists and researchers herbal products and plants they think will help cure the coronavirus or at least alleviate symptoms. About 70% of Ghanaians depend on herbal remedies for their health care. Last year, general hospitals began integrating the practitioners and trained them to incorporate scientific methods into their work. Stacey Note reports for VOA from Mapaung Akwampe.
The Centre for Plant Medicine Research grew out of a visit by a Ghanaian doctor to China in the 1960s to learn from Chinese herbal medicine. The centre's acting executive director, Kofi Bobby Barama, dreams of finding a cure for COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus that came from China. And he's not the only one. Some people come to the centre located in a lush, mountainous area in Ghana's eastern region, claiming they have a cure for the virus revealed to them in a dream.
What we've told them is that it's good that it's been revealed to you, but at the Centre for Plant Medicine Research, what we do is that we do research to look at the safety of it and then also to make sure that it's something that can be consumed by the public, and we also make sure that it's something that is plant-based.
In the labs of the centre, researchers have been testing local herbal products to see what might help in Ghana's fight against COVID-19. So far, they have recommended herbal products to boost immunity. But the centre is also testing and planning trials of herbal medicines against the virus, scientist Alfred Mpoma Apia says.
Herbs have what we call phytonutrients or phytoconstituents. And when we use these herbs, they have a broad activity that helps the whole. We might contribute to health a lot.
Ghanaians' belief in traditional plant-based medicine is widespread. The centre grows medicinal plants to help with a range of diseases and conditions, including malaria, typhoid and high blood pressure, Michael Ofori, a technologist at the centre, says.
Our forefathers were using these herbs long before we were born, but they didn't have the scientific means to research and know the actual dosage of the plant. Now we are being privileged to have that technology at hand. So then we have to then attach that technology to the herbal aspects that can be very safe for us to consume.
In a town close to the centre, trader Abena Oye says she relies on herbal remedies and hopes Ghana will find a traditional cure for COVID-19.
Oh, because yare.
She says it would make them happy because the illness is something that is worrying us. All our finances are messed up, says Oye. The whole world is a mess. So if the medicine comes, she says, we will be very happy and we will take it and it will help us and Ghana will be held in high esteem. That is also the ultimate goal of Ghana's Centre for Plant Medicine Research. But any treatment, they say, must rely on scientific evidence, not just dreams. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Akuapim Mampong, Ghana.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, how are the COVID-19 patients treated in South Sudan? This story is coming up after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how can you help someone dealing with depression? I just give my time to that person and we discuss matter concerning that depression which that person is facing.
First of all, I'll find out what is depressing that person. And when I find out the root cause, of course, I try to advise the person according to what he or she is going through.
By counseling the person through counseling and then sharing ideas. Maybe sometimes going out for football or watching football, movies, such things can also help.
I recommend music, the music therapy. Music therapy in the sense that music has a way of giving a soothing feeling whenever the person listens to music.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. In our Tuesday health segment, we look at Dr. John Garang's Center for Infectious Disease. Doctors at the John Garang Center for Infectious Disease Unit say they are doing everything possible to save the lives of COVID-19 patients isolated at the center. The doctors say patients admitted at the center range from 18 to 70 years of age. A doctor working for the International Medical Corps says health workers visit patients at least four times in a day. For VOA News, Ding Magod reports from Juba.
Dr. James Chan Jok is head of South Sudan's National Rapid Response Team. He says after a patient dials the toll-free number 6666, health workers on the team reach out to the caller. They ask about the caller's symptoms, and depending on the symptoms tested for COVID-19, then refer to doctors at the John Garang Infectious Disease Unit for treatment.
Yes, the doctors can operate within RRT, possible. Because when they are investigating the patient there, they used to interview the patient, what is happening. They present the presentation complaint to the patients. The doctors will know that the patient is admitted the case definition, while all the signs and symptoms are already matching the case definitions. And from the another side, the doctors also will function in IDU, which is a John Garang infectious disease, to manage the patients. To manage all these signs and symptoms, whatever is shortness of breathing, the patient will be put on oxygen. Whatever is a fever and all this, the patient will be given some medication to relieve from all this.
Dr. Abdul Sebushishe, the technical lead for IMC, says if a patient has COVID-19 symptoms or is in critical condition, medical staff at the John Garang Infectious Disease Unit send an ambulance to pick up the patient.
If a patient is confirmed to be positive and the rapid response team think that the patient need to be admitted at Juba Infectious Disease Unit, we send the ambulance to pick him. Doctors and nurses at Infectious Disease Unit mobilize themselves. They put on the protective gear and receive the patient. They take his history. They take his vital signs and do a quick triage before admitting him in a level 1 intensive care unit or in a general ward.
Dr. Sebushishe says medical staff at the facility visit patients at least four times a day. He says if a patient in intensive care, doctors and nurses monitor the patient's condition throughout the day.
Every morning we have to also make sure we are protected before we go to see the patient, collect their daily vital signs, give them medication when it's required, and provide psychosocial support for those who are admitted at Juba IDU.
Dr. Sebushishe says patients who are critically ill are put in level 1 ward where patients require oxygen ventilators.
So because we some of the patients require special monitoring and special treatment, like being on oxygen more than others, that's what I call level 1, because it's just a room with oxygen with additional monitoring devices for blood pressure, for pulse, for oxygen saturation in one room. And we call it level 1 because of the number of times that nurses and doctors have to enter that room to make sure that the patient oxygen that is supplied to him is working adequately, or he need additional support. But also for patients who require another specific supportive treatment, if they have severe malaria, if they have diabetes or hypertension, and they need a special follow-up, we put them in that particular room.
Dr. Sebushishe points out there is no treatment for COVID-19, but medical workers provide supportive care and psychosocial support to patients.
At the moment, there is no treatment for COVID, but we do what we call supportive treatment, meaning we treat the symptoms that the patient has. If the patient come with signs of severe malaria, then we go ahead and treat severe malaria. If the patient has diabetes and been confirmed COVID-19, we focus on management of diabetes to allow the body to remain in good shape and kick out the virus by itself.
Dr. Sebushishe says patients who experience no COVID-19 symptoms should remain in isolation for 14 days.
One of the major challenges, when we need to update every time our knowledge to make sure that we don't stay behind. This disease is, is fast moving. A lot of researchers are coming out, and we need to stay up to date to make sure that we provide treatment based on the facts that have been proven to work other places.
107 staff members work at the Dr. John Garang Infectious Disease Unit, including 4 doctors, 10 technical officers. For VOA News, I am Ding Magot in Juba.
Sudanese authorities have extended the partial lockdown of the capital Khartoum for an additional 14 days to reduce the spread of the coronavirus. Officials at the Ministry of Health say 12 people died from COVID-19 over the past 24 hours, bringing the nationwide death toll to 298. For VOA News, Michael Atid reports from Khartoum.
Despite a directive by the government for people to stay home to minimize the spread of the pandemic, Khartoum and other towns continue to register cases of COVID-19. For that reason, they say, they are extending the lockdown period within Khartoum for 2 more weeks to prevent the spread of the pandemic. 147 new cases of COVID-19 were reported over the past 24 hours, bringing the total number to 5,173. Health officials also say 1,522 people have recovered from COVID-19 since the outbreak was first reported in Sudan in February. Addressing reporters in Khartoum last night, the co-chair of the Sudan's high-level task force for COVID-19, Professor Sadiq Taur, said Khartoum has 4,078 of the roughly 5,100 cases. Speaking in Arabic, he calls the infection rate worrying.
The suspension of all forms of social gatherings shall remain imposed as before. All bridges linking Khartoum, Omdurman, and Khartoum North shall remain closed unless you have a permission. All travels between the states and from Khartoum to other states shall remain suspended till further notice.
Taur noted the committee is grateful to all medical workers and organized forces who, he says, have been working tirelessly to fight the spread of the disease.
The committee hereby appreciates the heroic and noble sacrifices that have been shown by our Sudanese medical staff in defending the people of Sudan against this destructive virus. They have been working patiently and professionally to safeguard any individual soul in this country.
Khartoum resident Maryam Ishaq, who used to work as a tea seller in Khartoum's Al Arabi market, criticized the government's decision to extend the lockdown for another 2 weeks. Speaking in Arabic, Ishaq says, for 2 months, people like her have not been able to earn money to feed their families.
We are living by the grace of God. What we have stocked has been consumed during the months of Ramadan. We have been eating dry bread for a couple of days now, but still kids don't understand the situation. Their demand still remains the same. I just came to work if I'm able to get few pounds to provide them with food.
Taur is urging all Sudanese citizens across the country to strictly follow the protective measures announced by health authorities to fight the spread of the disease. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
As peaceful and some chaotic protests continue across the United States and many cities put in place curfews, there is increasing concerns about journalists being targeted by police with rubber bullets, tear gas, and arrest as they cover the demonstrations. President Donald Trump blamed the protest on, quote, lamestream media. Courtney Ratch, advocate director with the Committee to Protect Journalists, talks to international edition Lori Lodin for reaction and how they are monitoring the ongoing situation.
I was standing in front of the 5th Police Precinct in Minneapolis. Broken windows. Across the street is a post office that's burnt to the ground. Next to that is a large bank, burnt to the ground. Down the street, more buildings burnt to the ground. More than 255 businesses in Minneapolis and St. Paul no longer exist. Mm. You go to the 3rd Police District, it's completely gutted. So what we're seeing right now is empty streets and people bewildered, scared, tired. And when it gets dark, we know that it's coming again. Is it over? No. We have 3 times as many police in the streets as we had normally. And we're in lockdown at 8 p.m. until 6 a.m.
When you say it's coming again, what are you meaning?
What I expect to see is more protests on the one side, in many cases, peaceful protests. But there's another element here, and that other element brings violence. And that element brings potentially more arson, brings guns, gunshots, brings responses from the police. And so what you're seeing is this ramping up back and forth. The problem is there are no winners, and yet we're here one more night. I don't even know. Is this day 5?
What about the police presence? How are they responding? We've been seeing a lot of violence across the country in many, many cities. And who are the people out there protesting? Are they all people that are fed up with what they see as continued inequality in the justice system? Or are there others participating, and how are police responding out there?
There are a lot of police in the street right now, and they are ramping up. It's not just police, it's actually National Guard as well. And so in combination, you're seeing that ramping up. Are they getting more aggressive? Absolutely they are. Are they firing more rubber bullets? Absolutely. Are they using more tear gas? No question about it. That is taking place as we speak. In fact, we have seen just in the last couple of days, multiple sets of reporters arrested, shot with rubber bullets, even after they have their insignia out, even though they say, we're press, where do you want us to go? They're still getting shot. And so that's happening even in the last couple of days. I think that's just a hint of what we're dealing with. There's multiple kinds of people in the street right now. I think there are those people who are simply trying to get justice served. At the same time, there are others out there that seem to have an agenda. One of the groups that I absolutely know is here because I have people I know talking about it and seeing them on the streets, and these are white supremacists. They are here. Some about 6 blocks from where I live right now, there were white supremacists in the streets. And there are others who continue to come, apparently not from Minnesota, but they're coming for that reason too. So they are here as well. And that exacerbates all of this, because then the question is, what is this about? Is this about George Floyd, the man who was killed on Monday by this police officer? Or is this about something else, a greater agenda? That's the question everybody has right now.
How can you be sure that these are white supremacists or white nationalists?
You have people with out-of-state plates, Trump hats. They have stickers on the backs of their cars that are white supremacist stickers. What that means is there's a certain cross that you will see that represents white supremacy. They had them on both of these SUVs.
That's Courtney Rudd, Advocacy Director with Committee to Protect Journalists, talking with my colleague Lori Lodin. That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with Simon Kero with his song, Corona Ja. I am John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers, because there is no cure for the coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Lele mama 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 basma malum mama corona
corona jakom virus, corona, corona jakom virus, corona, corona jakom kasele yeda gai moi sabun, kasele yeda ebi sabun.